Last week we had the first part of about the parable of the prodigal son, and this evening we're going to look at the second part of the part that deals with the other son. He doesn't get quite as much PR as does the prodigal son, or the one that's called the prodigal son. And as you remember from last week, for those who were here, that the word prodigal means lavish, and you can put it for the son who went away and spent his money in lavish living, but you can also put it for God because of his lavish love. And the portrayal of the son coming back, then we have the father unconditionally accepting the son back, and that's lavish love, and that's what God has for us, is this wonderful lavish love. In fact, there is a popular Christian book that's out right now called The Prodigal God, and it's taken from that and talking about the lavish love of God. But this evening we're going to talk about the other son. And here's the prodigal son in the key of F. Feeling footloose and frisky, a feather-brained fellow forced his fawn-feathered father to fork over the finances. He fled far to foreign fields and frittered his fortune, feasting fabulously with faithless friends. Finally, facing famine and fleeced by his fellows in folly, he found himself a fed-fingered in a filthy farmyard. Barely famishing, he feigned would have filled his frame with the 40s food of the fodder fragments. Fooey, my father's flunkies, far finer, the frazzled fugitive found feverishly, frankly facing facts. Frustrated by failure and filled with foreboding, he forthwith fled to his father and family. Falling at his father's feet, he floundered for lonely father, I have flunked. I have fruitlessly forfeited family favor. But the faithful father, forestalling further flinching, frantically flagged a flunky, fetched forth the finest fatling and fixed the feast. But the fugitive's fault, finding brother, frowned on the fickle forgiveness of the former folderol. His fury flashed, but fussing was futile, for the far-sighted father figured such fidelity is fine, that what forbids fervent festivities for the fugitive is found. Fly the flags, with fanfares flaring, let fun and frolic freely flow. Former failure is forgotten, folly forsaken, forgiveness forms the foundation for future fellowship. Or we can turn to this translation. This is the Common English Bible, relatively new translation, in Luke the 15th chapter, and read it from there, starting with Luke 15, and we're just going to read the part dealing with the older son in verse 25. Now his older son was in the field, coming in from the field. He approached the house and heard music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked what was going on. The servant replied, your brother has arrived, and your father has slaughtered the fatted calf because he received his son back safe and sound. And the older son was furious and didn't want to enter in, but his father came out and begged him. He answered his father, look, I've served you all these years, and I never disobeyed your instructions, yet you've never given me such as a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours returned after gobbling up your estate on prostitutes, you slaughtered the fatted calf for him. And then his father said, son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we have to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. How to avoid a pity party. How to avoid a pity party, and this is, of course, of what is going on, and often when we're involved in a pity party, the one thing that we do like to do is send out invitations and invite other people to our pity party. Now, they happen from time to time to people and circumstances. Some happen for a short time, some happen as a lifetime, but often when they occur, we look for others to be involved. We want somebody else to know just how pitiful our life is and the circumstances. When we get to this chapter, this particular chapter of the Bible, Luke 15, this is the lost and found chapter and department of the Bible. We have the lost sheep in this one, which we've already done that parable, the lost coin, and now the lost son here beginning in this. The lost son, the other son, the son that doesn't get as much out of this, we find that he had several things happen. He was angry, he was bitter, he was upset, he was sulking, he was stubborn, he was sullen, he was jealous, and he was full of self-pity. What did he have that was so much more, what he had was so much more than that which he did not have, but by dwelling on the negatives, he spoiled what he did have because of what he did not have. And it's like a boil, it just kept getting bigger and bigger. There's an Old Testament story similar to this that dealt with this. It was the King Ahab who looked upon a vineyard that was near his castle, the Naboth's vineyard, and he looked at that vineyard and how beautiful that vineyard was and how productive that vineyard was. And he looked at it every day, and he wanted that vineyard. Eventually, his envy for that vineyard grew and grew and grew, and he was puffed up with pride. He was swelled with selfishness. He was controlled by another power, and eventually, because he actually says that he went in and he lay down and on a bed and he threw a fit. He threw a tantrum because he couldn't have that. Well, lucky for him, of course, he had a wife who was able to take care of that, and she saw that Naboth was killed and gave that vineyard then to her husband. But it all began, and it was a wonderful story if you want to put it that way. But it's a wonderful example of somebody in the Old Testament who gave themselves a pity party to be trying to get things their own way. There is a cost, curse here that goes along with this of self-pity. He says, by dwelling on the negative spoil of what he did have, by thinking about what he did not have, which I already mentioned, the curse of self-pity is that it destroys our happiness. See in verse 28, he comes home. What does it say? Then the older son was furious. He was coming home from the field of a rather productive, maybe not one way or the other in his feelings, necessarily, until he came to the house and he heard there was joy going on. And he wasn't a part of it. Nobody had bothered to take the time, apparently, to go out in the field and say, hey, come back to the house, there's going to be a party. You might want to kick off early this evening. You know, you might want to take and let somebody else take over the sheep this afternoon so that you can come in for the party. Well, he didn't know about it. As he got closer to the house, he heard it and realized he must be missing out on something. And so his reaction was, it says there that his son was furious and he didn't want to enter in. Well, I'll show them, you know, they're inside feasting, they're inside having fun, they're inside dancing and laughing and singing and eating the food, and I'll show them, I'll be mad and I'll stand outside. You know, it didn't make a lot of sense. But that's what happens when we get into the pity party. It doesn't make any sense. And who in the world was he punishing in that? Was he punishing his dad who was inside? Was he punishing his brother who had just come back? Was he punishing all the other people that were involved inside who were dancing and singing and eating? The only person, of course, who was paying a penalty here was the brother with his self-pity. He was angry, would not go in. Secondly, it destroys our usefulness. 28 says he was needed in the harvest, but instead he was a distraction. Let's see how it says it in this translation in verse 28. It says that, but his father came out and begged him. And he answered, Father, look, I've served you all these years. I've never obeyed your instructions. He ceased to be a productive individual at this point because of the pity that it took over. He was needed in the work, but he was distracted by that. And that happens, of course, not only in individuals within their relationships within their family. It happens to individuals in relationship to their church. something doesn't go exactly the way that they want it to go to church, and so they have those pity parties. But you're needed in the work. Well, I ain't going back till they do this or that. I'm not gonna be a part of that. And so what happens? Who's the person that pays the penalty? It's always you in the end when you get involved in the pity party. The others go on without you. Now, you can go with them if you want. But often you're still back there with arms crossed and waiting and angry because it's not the way that you want it. Third, it destroys our oneness. As soon as this thy son has come. Notice how he this reference, how he does that. This thy son says, but when this son of yours returned, after gobbling up your estate on prostitutes, you slaughtered the fatted calf for him. He didn't say, hey, this my brother. Notice he chose different language. He disassociated himself with his own brother. He says, yeah, this your son. Look what he's done. And he put him in a different category altogether. Now, he's not happy that his brother came back. The cause of self-pity, of course, is a restricted vision. In verse 29 here, notice those words, I, me, my, that's in here. He answered his father, look, I've served you all these years. I've never disobeyed your instruction. Yet you've never given me as much as a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. It's all about me. You see, this, the world must center around me. At least that's what the father, what the son is saying here to his father. You've never done these for me. Same thing happens. Family relationships, church relationships, everything must revolve around me. And my wants and my needs and my desire. There is a personality in the Old Testament that said this, for thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will set also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, I will be like the Most High. Notice how many times in that passage, whoever that person is, that personality is, or whatever it is, the word I is used in what they were going to accomplish and where they wanted to be. And of course, it distorts our values here. Verse 29 says, you know, I never killed a kid for me. Now, that's not a young child, you know, but it's a goat. So he never killed one, never even killed a goat from here. Here you killed a calf for him. You know? And of course, he would not have been satisfied if his father had killed a goat for him. Now, when I read this, I think it's a wonder he didn't get his father's goat in this, all this, you know, but if his father had killed a goat for him, that would not have satisfied him up to this point. Because his father killed the fatted calf for his brother. It would nothing would have done unless everything had been equal. If he had killed the fatted calf for him. I'd have, you know, if he has a fatted calf, I'd have to have a fatted calf. Never mind what you've done before for me before, but it distorts our values here. He had the farm. He was living on the farm. He was working on the farm. He had all the values of the farm. He had been eating regular all this time, but all that stuff was forgotten. All that was taken and transpiring that was so much better in his life than in his brother's life, but he forgot all about that. He was just worried that never at one time did his dad kill a calf for him. Outrage virtue, verse 29. These many years I served thee. We like to bring up seniority sometimes and all this, you see? I mean, after all, I've been around for a long time. I ought to get more respect. I ought to be the first one you think. Again, it happens in family relationships. You know, I'm the oldest. I'm the one that needs to be paid attention to. I should be the one that has all the advantage. It happens in churches, too, you know. I've been here for 45 years. And so I should have a say in the way that the church goes. Happens in churches, happens in people. We talk about how many years we served, but wait a minute, we never talk about all the benefits that came along the way, do we? The cure here for self-pity is abiding presence. Now notice in this story, of course, when we talk about this, we realize that in the characters that are involved in this, particularly the character of the Father. We well identified the Father last week as God who is welcoming us all the time. I noticed then here in verse 31, then his Father said, Son, you're always with me. And everything I have is yours. You're always with me. Well, that's good. That's a good thing, and that's a good place to be, to abide in the presence of God. You see, what the son found out the hard way, the son that we often refer to as the prodigal son, what he found out the hard way is that when you're not abiding in the presence of your Father, things are difficult. In fact, they're difficult to the point that you almost will die. And indeed, in this story, if we're talking about God as the Father here, there are those who stay away from the presence of the Father so long that they do die without ever regaining that relationship. He had abundant provision, verse 31. No. But says, everything I have is yours. And it's true. Everything that God has is ours. Now, I know there are people who are worried about our economy. I mean, there's some reason to be worried about that to some degree. But you know what? There ain't much about this economy that I can control. I don't have a big influence on any political personage. I don't have a big amount of money that I can give away. I'm not even sure I can take care of my own personal situation. But you know, all that pales in comparison to what God has for us. Everything that he has created, everything around us, it's his. It's for our use. It's for our use. The achieved purpose here in verse 32, the main goal is to bring people to Christ, of course. But we have to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. It's wonderful when one comes back to a close relationship with God. It's wonderful when one that has gone away comes back. It's wonderful when one who has never experienced what God can do comes to him. The interesting thing sometimes is this. We, as the people of God, do not rejoice enough sometimes over someone who has made their decision, who has come back and reconnected with God, as much as God and the angels of heaven do. That's what it says in here. It tells us that there is rejoicing in heaven when one that is lost comes and unites himself with God. Now, what would make you the happiest in this world? Maybe you'd be ecstatic if you was the Powerball winner tonight. Millions of dollars. Maybe it's a house. You got this big house in your mind, and you want that house, and that would make you the happiest. But maybe it's a car. It could be all sorts of things like that. Now, whatever it is that makes you the happiest, now think about that. What would make you the happiest in this world, whatever that is, take and elevate that happiness beyond whatever that is. That's the happiness that we should have when someone comes to Christ. We should be exuberant. We should be thrilled. We should be joyful. We should be dancing and feasting. But we have to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours is dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.